We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
In this hour of the program, we'll look into the history of artificial sweeteners. It is a history that stretches back to the 1893 World's Fair. That's when saccharin made its debut as an artificial sweetener. But saccharin and the artificial sweeteners that followed wouldn't become popular until the latter half of the 20th century. Our guest is historian Carolyn de la Peña. She is the author of the new book, Empty Pleasures, the story of artificial sweeteners from saccharin to Splenda. She says the story of artificial sweeteners tells us much about, in her words, our vexed relationship with food. In Empty Pleasures, Carolyn de la Peña gives us a story that describes a revolution in ideas about the consumption of food. The players include the food and pharmaceutical industries, advertisers, entrepreneurs, women's magazines, and ultimately, you and me. After all, the lure of having your cake and eating it, too, is a strong one. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a phone call or by email. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. The toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL, and the email address is will-talk@illinois.edu. Carolyn de la Peña is a professor of American Studies at the University of California, Davis. Her latest book, Empty Pleasures, is published by the University of North Carolina Press. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, the email address will-talk@illinois.edu. Carolyn de la Peña, good afternoon, or good morning, excuse me. How are you?
I'm great, thank you.
So how did you become interested in this history?
Well, I grew up in a house that was probably fairly typical for Southern California, middle-class family in the 1970s, where we had, you know, you open up the refrigerator, and here's this array of artificial products. So Crystal Light was the beverage. Egg beaters instead of eggs, I'm sure listeners remember, or perhaps use now. I can't believe it's not butter. So I think I've always been fascinated by those products, which seemed very normal to me, and most of them I stopped using at some point in my 20s. So with this project, I thought, well, I'm going to go back and write a history of all of those things because I'm really interested in our relationship between technology and how we think about our bodies. And I was surprised to find that there really weren't histories of any of those things. And so I thought I would start with what I discovered was the first substitute ingredient that was used especially to promote health, and that was artificial sweetener.
Yeah. You've weighed now the pros and cons of artificial sweeteners. What are they?
Well, you know, as a historian, I mean, my first answer I try to give to this is that, you know, the pros and the cons historically are that artificial sweetener has been used by many people on the side of its invention and promotion, you know, for very positive reasons. It's allowed people in the food industry to innovate. It's allowed them to develop partnerships with pharmaceutical companies. And I think if you asked many of those inventors and promoters, they would say that they really wanted to make it easier to make a healthy choice in the marketplace, right? And much of the stuff comes out of the 1950s when there's this general cultural climate of mass production and the encouragement of consumption. Food is cheaper. The modern grocery store is created. So there are all of these choices that consumers can make, and I think that producers have really tried to enable healthy choices. But on the other hand, they've made a tremendous amount of money by promoting products that have no nutritional value. Right? So a big con that I discovered was as soon as we begin to sell something that's healthy, right, like, quote, healthy, it removes calories from sweetness, in artificial sweetener, then there's instantly an industry that stands to gain if we consume as much of it as possible. So, in fact, you can really chart this parallel rise in, you know, Diet Coke and diet desserts and guilt-free yogurts and the proliferation of messages that we should be eating, that we should be wanting to eat constantly, and that sweetness should be part of our daily lives in a way that's just not sort of what nature intended when there's a relationship between calories and sweets. So I think my short answer at the end of a long answer is it's actually artificial sweetener has enabled the promotion of more eating at the same time that it's supposed to make it easier for us to make healthy choices or even lose weight.
The rise of artificial sweeteners began their ascent in earnest following World War II. You note this was the time when Americans were encouraged to acquire more. So how was the link forged between consuming ever more in terms of food and building a healthy nation?
Well, there's actually an entrepreneur in the diet product industry in the 1960s who had a great phrase, and it was prosperity stomach. And he diagnosed it as this condition facing Americans. So we had the means to produce cheap food. People had the ability to buy food. We had technological conveniences that made it easier to make complete meals, right, from appetizer to meal to dessert. But there was this calorie barrier of the body. And there's a strange bind for consumers, right? We have in the 1950s this renewed focus on slimness, especially for whites and in the middle and upper class. And so having to focus on the at the same time on being thin meant that consumers were more likely to choose not to buy foods, right? But the foods were actually cheap and easy to produce. So that relationship really came out of the early industries. I look in the book a lot at the canning companies. It's kind of counterintuitive. We mostly think about diet soda these days, but it was actually the canners who were the first to use saccharin and cyclamates, a sweetener that was taken off the market in the U.S. in 1969. And the reasons that they did it, when I look back in the archives, this relationship between pharmaceutical companies that developed these sweeteners and the canning companies was that, you know, canners needed to expand their market. After the war, they were selling less canned food because people were using more frozen foods and fresh foods. And so they saw a real opportunity to enter into a market that really hadn't been, its potential hadn't really been realized. So from canners on the West Coast, mostly, they came up with diet fruit, and diet fruit led to diet syrups, and that ultimately led to diet sodas. But those entrepreneurs in those industries were really aware that in order to sell enough product, they had to find a niche, and in diet fruit, that's what they found.
Saccharin, as I mentioned, made its debut at the 1893 World's Fair. How was it received?
Well, although I found pamphlets that suggested that Konstantin Fallberg, who was the one of the original inventors of saccharin, that he was trying to market it to the public, and I think he was passing out brochures to people who came, most of the people in 1893 who were impacted by that the display he had at the World's Fair were food manufacturers. So, in fact, what happened was carbonated beverage manufacturers began to switch from using sugars to saccharin. And they did that because saccharin is about 200 times sweeter per part than table sugar, and it's also cheaper, right? It's not produced in a market that could be volatile, and it's controllable in the lab. So carbonated beverage manufacturers started using it, unbeknownst to most American consumers. And as part of that Food and Drug Act progressive reforms between about 1906 and 1912, you can go back and read these New York Times articles as consumers begin to discover that sugar has been replaced by this adulterant, chemical, impure saccharin. because at that moment, sugar was seen as a really positive product.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cheap form of important calories and a good source of nutrition. So its debut did not go well, and that's, I think, why you don't really see the reemergence of artificial sweeteners until the 1950s.
Yeah. Now, when saccharin was going into things like soft drinks, did people realize that, hey, this tastes different?
There's not a lot of coverage of people noticing the taste difference, and I think that that's probably because carbonated beverages were pretty variable depending on, you know, where you were getting it from, what soda fountain. There wasn't a lot of control over the product. So I expected to see more of that because saccharin has what many people call kind of a bitter or metallic aftertaste.
Mm-hmm.
But oftentimes they were using solutions that were part sugar and part saccharin, which could have been why it masked the taste. But interestingly, as soon as the story breaks that there's this chemical in your soda, then suddenly people begin to kind of write in and say, you know, this sort of chemical, this bitter, this terrible thing, which suggests that relationship between, you know, once you know it's there or you think it's bad, it's bad.
Right? Mm.
Before that, people don't seem to notice.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about W.O. Atwater.
Well, W.O. Atwater was an early expert in nutrition, and his ideas were pretty important in the first part of the 20th century. And he came up with these charts to sort of, he was often focused on working class and immigrants and how could we make sure that people were getting the appropriate nutrition. And in his charts, that's where sugar really was, you could see what a positive product it was because it was cheaper and it delivered the most calories of most of the other available carbohydrates. So Atwater's ideas are really what helped make sugar a health food. And it wasn't until really the 1950s and especially in the 1970s that there's this popular revolt against sugar, where we focus specifically on sugar as a problem in the American diet. And I find that interesting that within that brief 50-year period, we went from really praising sugar and insisting that kids eat it. You know, there were all these advertisements, sugar companies jumped on this bandwagon, and Domino Sugar had a series of ads with children with rosy cheeks, make sure he gets all of his sugar, which, of course, during World War II was even more heightened because there was the sugar shortage.
Mm.
So it was important to, you know, save sugar and make sure that only that children and soldiers had sugar, and really that idea that sugar would win the war.
Mm. It now seems we've come full circle. It seems that sugar is the new comeback kid.
Yeah, I think it's fairly mixed. It seems that way from advertisements. I think that soda companies have really begun to focus on natural, on consumers' interest in products that seem natural. A recent study found that 60% of consumers, even though there's some, the figure is around 200 million. Americans who regularly consume artificial sweeteners, about 50% of American households, that 60% of people asked said, you know, artificial sweeteners, they're probably bad. There's probably something bad about them. Even though the sales continue to increase, especially for Splenda, which is the most recent artificial sweetener. But at the same time, companies are very aware that those concerns about artificial sweetener or about things that are unnatural, right, that they need to come out with products that can get out in front of that. So the eat local, eat organic, that movement has an impact even on soda. And so there's the throwback sodas that use sugar, right, instead of using corn syrup, because corn syrup's also been maligned. And sugar sort of has reemerged as maybe it's helpful now. I think we move in these cycles of and that it's a larger problem with kind of vilifying ingredients or seeing them as, you know, suddenly they're great again, which causes this consumer confusion. So sugar's gone from important to terrible. You shouldn't touch it. It causes hyperactivity. It's the key source of weight gain to now coming back in as being natural. But most of the consumers that I've talked with, you know, are suspect at this point of any of those claims that, you know, a soda is good or that sugar might be good. It's more kind of a general distrust of health claims by the industry altogether.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. The final sentence of your book is this: we may find that in spite of suggestions to the contrary, if we are going to have our cake, we must learn to eat it too.
I found in NutraSweet a particular history that I think most of us don't know and really should. NutraSweet came on the market in 1982, and NutraSweet is aspartame, which is the third of the artificial sweeteners. There's been four. And NutraSweet was a profoundly different product. It really developed a message that was, you know, artificial sweeteners are not for women who are dieting. They are not for people who, excuse that sound, they are not for people who have to make a choice because they're watching their weight in any way. They're actually just what nature intended. That artificial sweetener is not artificial. It is just a modification of proteins that exist in nature, and that the secret has been found to basically create a sweet form of pleasure that did not have consequences. And this was, Donald Rumsfeld was the CEO of Cyril when they put NutraSweet on the market. And that message, in a direct quote from them, is that there is such a thing as a free lunch, delivered to hundreds of thousands of households in the form of gumballs. Maybe some listeners remember those gumballs. We actually got them. That were totally separating the idea that artificial sweetener was a diet product to use sometimes, and instead that now you could have sweets anytime you wanted. And that's when the proliferation of artificially sweetened foods begins, where, you know, almost every product that's sweet in the grocery store would have a corresponding product that was now a diet sweet. Right? And often that word diet totally removed, and instead that happy little swirly symbol of NutraSweet. And I think that NutraSweet, by expanding the market for diet foods 150% at that moment, really did kind of make this fundamental shift where there wasn't a need to have sweets once in a while. And what I call indulgent restraint emerged, that we're dieting and we're having less and we're being careful and we're making good choices by having sweets all the time. And that's that moment where I think when you connect that also to the politics, there are many conspiracy theories about Rumsfeld and that aspartame is quite bad for us and is dangerous, and that the FDA was manipulated. The archives don't reveal that to be true, but what it does show is that there's this moment where you go from President Carter and the speech in 1979 about the importance of restraint and that we have to begin to make choices to use less energy, to make different choices as consumers, right? And that shift to Reagan, you know, with a new day and supply-side economics, and that we actually can have it all. We just have to make more and have more. You know, it's not that artificial sweetener caused that, but that it was this way that the promise of eating and pleasure equaling health, and that you didn't have to do without, that promise became part of our everyday lives. And I think that it had a profound impact on people's dietary choices, but that also we just kind of put pleasure in this place where there was no need to have it once in a while because we could have it whenever we wanted. And that's one of the messages in the book I try to look at. That was a message that was very good for industry. It's made many, many millions of dollars for the promoters of diet plans and artificially sweetened foods and Jenny Craig and Weight Watchers. And yet obesity has continued to rise. In spite of that proliferation of all of those diet foods, we haven't become any more diet people than we were.
What lessons do you see in this story for those concerned about what we're eating and how much we're eating today?
I think that often we focus on sort of the magic bullet or the technological fix, which is what historians often call it, in our attitudes towards food. And it's not our fault for doing that. We're in a society where, you know, there's always some new message that something we have to learn. Eggs are good. Eggs are bad. Sugar is bad. Sugar is good. Artificial sweetener is good. It's bad. And it's very difficult to make good choices in that climate. And the takeaway that I hope people have is that all of those messages that are created around health by the food industry are created primarily to generate profit. And sometimes that coincides with a healthy choice, but many times it doesn't. The basic message to consume more food than we need either to accomplish the day's tasks or to have an appropriate, sustainable, healthy weight, right? That the food industry needs to move more food through us than our bodies can healthfully consume. That what we can do inside that world really is, instead of asking, right, what should I eat, to ask that question, why? Why am I eating? That's the message that I think has been very hard for us to have, that understanding of an appropriate appetite. Why do I want to eat something right now? What is it that's making me want it? Is it all of the advertising messages that surround me, or is it that I'm hungry? It's very hard for us to have a good relationship to our own hunger and our own food desire. So that's one of the things that I would really hope people would take away. You know, that part we can control. The other parts generated by the food industry, much harder to ultimately trust.
Yeah. I'm intrigued by Michael Pollan's three rules.
Mm.
You know, eat food, mostly plants. And what's the third one? Not so much. I can't remember it now. See, I can't even remember three easy rules. But I'm wondering, you know, what do you see on the horizon? Is there hope for us?
Oh, I think there's so much hope for us. You know, there's everywhere I talk about this project, people are excited to talk about food. You know, I think I teach classes on food, too, and 5 to 7 years ago, this wasn't the case. There's so much interest in understanding where our food comes from and how to make good choices. And I think just that we're all so much, we ask much better questions now than we used to. It means that the industry is going to have to deliver answers. I mean, look at Walmart carrying organic produce. I mean, companies carry the products that consumers tell them they must carry. And I think for a long time, consumers have been on the receiving end of healthy health information from companies. And we're now on the end to generate some of that information. So I do think, though, that it's important, you know, eat real food. That's been a profoundly important message to people. And Michael Pollan's work has been just at the front of this movement. But I also try to encourage people to realize that, you know, again, it's not let's avoid the magic bullet. It's not just switching from what we eat here to organic produce or to something produced locally. It's how do we have a good relationship to our appetite? I'm much more of the school that it doesn't, you can eat many, many things. You know, food is not fundamentally unhealthful. It's our relationship to it that's become so vexed because of industry. If I want to eat a bag of Cheetos now and then or have a Diet Coke or have a real Coke, none of that should be a huge problem. The problem is in how many of those Cheetos am I eating? Why am I drinking 6 Diet Cokes a day? That question of quantity, I think, is one that we really have to explore.
Mm. From Illinois Public Media, this is Focus on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn, and in this hour of Focus, we're talking with historian Carolyn de la Peña. She is the author of the new book, Empty Pleasures, The Story of Artificial Sweeteners from Saccharin to Splenda. She says this story, it tells us a lot about, in her words, our vexed relationship with food. Listeners, I invite you to join us this morning with a phone call or by email. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. 222-WILL, the email address, will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, let's go back and talk about this history, because it is so fascinating, and it involves so many people and so many facets of our culture. Part of the story that I'd like you to talk about is women's liberation from the corset, and with time, you say, saccharin and cyclamates emerged as, quoting you, powerful deliverers of a woman's will. Would you talk about that?
Sure. You could see that happening across the time periods with artificial sweetener. You know, it's not a product that was imposed on women by men. It's much more complicated than that. So when you go back and you look in the 1940s during World War II, that was actually when artificial sweetener first became a product that women chose. And much of that, I think, was driven by sugar shortages. So women actually, you know, walked into drugstores and bought capsules, little pills of saccharin that had been left on the market for diabetics, and used them. And I have a collection, and there's some of these in the book, of little kind of beautiful containers that were developed to house these saccharin or later cyclamate pills. And there's even cookbooks that were created by women for other women around, you know, what do you do? You can't get sugar. How do you use these little saccharin pills? Can you dissolve them in water? Can you cook with them? Can you can with them? And I argue in the book that artificial sweetener, although this is before the kind of mass marketing, you know, you couldn't go into a store and buy it as an ingredient in food, but that this is kind of a hidden history of these little pills and powders. You know, this is the same era as the mother's helper, it's Valium and these pharmaceuticals that, you know, for better or worse, offered women an opportunity to sort of shape their own feelings, right, to take control in some way. And that the little pills, which you would use with these little tongs and take them out of the containers and put them in coffee and tea, that was a very different relationship to sweet than sugar, which had become something you did to feed your kids or feed your husband. Or sugar was kind of a responsibility ingredient, which had to do with it being considered so healthy. And that artificial sweetener was then something else. No, it wasn't defined. And so that gave women an opportunity to sort of use this to separate themselves from what I call that service of sweet, and to have a way that sweetness was focused on themselves, even so much as, you know, you're really looking at your finger as you try to take these little tablets out. And there's a kind of preciousness to that sweet. And that extends all the way up through NutraSweet, where even when it first emerged, It had a little, it said NutraSweet and then had the red and white swirl on products. And in advertisements, there was often a woman's hand, sort of her fingers reaching out and grabbing that swirl. And that really kind of mirrors those early saccharin pills where there was a choice to make. And NutraSweet went straight to women. It went to the woman who had to make choices for her household, you know, and the early advertisements, I'm sure many people would remember, were very kind of lengthy explanations of what NutraSweet is. You know, here's the 12 things you need to know about it, aimed at women, so that they would then go into the grocery store and demand that the manager begin to carry products that had that little symbol on them. It's so that in that long history, it's really a lot of it aimed at women wanting to make different kinds of choices for themselves. And you also see that among some of the early entrepreneurs. It was promoted by women. Canning executives were often women who began to use the sweetener in their products. And women's magazine editors and recipe section editors would often carry special stories on artificially sweetened products to teach other women how to use it and why.
Hmm. Tell us about Tilly Lewis and the Tasty Diet.
Tilly Lewis was known as the Tomato Queen. I'm waiting for the Tilly Lewis movie, which someone really needs to make. She was born in Brooklyn. She was the daughter of immigrants, and she, in her 20s and 30s, founded a tomato canning empire in Stockton. She was one of the only women in that industry. And during World War II, she enjoyed quite a bit of success manufacturing sea rations for the war effort. After World War II, Tilly in 1951 was the first to come up with a mass-marketed diet product, and that was the Tasty Diet. It was a line of artificially sweetened peaches and different kinds of fruits, all using saccharin. And what Tilly did, while other major canners were still trying to figure out how to break into this market, is Tilly went straight to women with her message. She actually had she had someone on staff who developed a 21-day diet plan, and she took it to over 50 newspapers across the country and combined her presence in the editorial office, right, where she would be interviewed, and that would then be carried in the newspaper story, with this diet plan where you could follow all of her instructions and you could lose weight. And so this was often accompanied by pictures of, you know, Battle of the Bulge and showing women using Tasty Diet products and getting on the scale and being remarkably reduced. But Tilly was very savvy. She focused on this message that she, as a woman, knew what it was like to be in the position of having to lose weight and how difficult it was. One of the advertisements in Life magazine showed a picture of Tilly sitting at a desk with a figure who's supposed to be her doctor, and it said, because the doctor put Tilly on a diet, you know, Tilly created the products for you. She didn't want to do without. This was her narrative. What she wanted was to have foods that were good, that tasted good, that she could have when she wanted, and because she wanted that, and she was a canner, and she was technologically savvy, she created it. In fact, she didn't create it. She knew very little about the technology. But that was the story, and the story was compelling. In one advertisement, she actually used a kind of election year, this was 1952, approach, and said, you know, Democrats or Republicans, every American has the right to anticipate, experience, and enjoy a complete meal, even if in doing that you're satisfying cravings that would lead to obesity. I mean, she really confronted head-on the idea that diet should mean doing without. Dieting should not mean sacrifice. Dieting should mean pleasure. And Tilly was really important to the next major entrepreneur in this industry, and that's Jean Nidetch of Weight Watchers, another character that I talk about. You know, Jean was one of the first to come up with a weight loss plan that was about membership and following rules. And you can see in the 1960s, as Weight Watchers is emerging, you know, in Jean's biography, she talks about, you know, when you're really hungry, you should keep a can of asparagus around so that, you know, when you can't do without food, you open the can of asparagus and you eat it. You know, you should keep a head of cabbage. This focus was on, yes, you might not be able to control your cravings, but here are the kinds of foods that won't, you know, do damage. Mm-hmm. But they weren't tasty foods. By the 1970s, Weight Watchers has their diet plan with their whole line of foods that really relies on a lot of saccharin. They create the label legal so that they can put it right down at the bottom of the page, this is a legal food versus an illegal food. And very much mirroring the approach that Tilly Lewis took, you know, there are the advertisements that come out. One of my favorites is the woman standing in front of the pantry door. Clearly, it's the middle of the night in her jammies, staring at a giant box of fudge brownies. You know, and are you going to let your cravings get out of control, or are you going to have Weight Watchers tasty artificially sweetened diet soda, right? Chocolate soda. So that message that, you know, you can have pleasure, and in fact more pleasure, by just switching your cravings to diet sweets was really promoted by these very smart women, you know, who were not evil. They were caught in a cultural moment when it was just impossible to do two things. You know, one, satisfy your cravings for food, and two, be thin. An artificial sweetener was just this perfect fix.
Hmm. When did we begin talking about dieting as an activity?
Really in the 1920s, the rise of the sort of new fashion of the flapper, the fact that more of the body was exposed, that was the first time that, diets emerge. But diets at that point mean things like eating grapefruit, right, or eating grapes, eating things that have a lot of liquid in them. So there was a focus on, you know, specific kinds of food replacements as a diet. But diet plans as a whole menu, a meal, a set of rules to follow, don't really emerge until the 1950s. And what's interesting about the story of artificial sweetener is that it's not, these worlds are not separate. I think we, you know, we're used to going into the grocery store, you see the advertisements, and then you think, you know, Diet Coke. I know what artificial sweetener is. It's that object over there. It's that food I'm going to choose or not choose. But actually, these webs are very linked between pharmaceutical companies who began to collaborate in the food supply through these products, and also to doctors, to the kinds of information we have about how much we should weigh. When Tilly Lewis created her diet plan, and she came up with this booklet of the 21-day diet, she sent 100,000 copies of this around to physicians, showing them that, you know, when women came to them with concerns about weight or when they felt like they needed to provide some advice, which was very difficult for male doctors to do for female patients. It wasn't an area they had much expertise in the 1950s. They could hand them a pamphlet, right? And in that pamphlet, it would direct them back to Tilly Lewis and diet foods. So there's been a way that those industries have collaborated with good intentions to produce health, but mostly what it's done is promoted the sales of more and more foods.
Mm. The marketing of artificial sweeteners to women was one key to their success. Today, it's interesting, men are also targets of this marketing. I started reading Empty Pleasures, I thought to myself, you know, what in the heck is the difference between Diet Coke and Coke Zero? And it's very interesting. One of the things that I learned from Answers.com was that Coke Zero is being marketed to men.
The word diet has that relationship to women. And it's a historical leftover from the early era of marketing these products. And I think what we're seeing now is the recognition that there is a limit to the amount of diet food that can be sold. And I'm not sure if that's because there are more and more studies in the last five years, that are actually revealing that when we use artificial sweetener, we may be more likely to gain weight than lose it, which is really troubling. And you know, why we haven't actually asked and answered that question a long time ago is curious. But the word diet has come to not mean either of the things it once did. You know, one, it meant eating asparagus and losing weight by doing without. Two, it meant you can have all the pleasure you want and you will still lose weight. Those products have become suspect. Coke Zero is a brave new terrain. And it's true, it escapes from that gendered marketing to women. It's actually trying to capture a younger market, a more active market, a male-oriented market, with what I think is really the distillation of these stories of Tilly and of Jean, and that it's not about diet. It's about zero. It's that this is pleasurable, this feels good, you can have it whenever you want, and there's nothing here. Right? And so in a way, Coke Zero is the most accurate marketing we've had of artificially sweetened foods. And I'm quite curious to see if that campaign will work by really removing any indication that this is about artificial sweetener or weight loss.
Have children been targeted by marketers in this regard?
Splenda represents a new attempt to hit that market. You know, I talked about the gumballs in NutraSweet and really comparing artificial sweetener in these products to candy and pleasure. But still, that was really aimed mostly at women. It was aimed at adults. If you go on and you look at Splenda.com right now, I would bet that what you'll see are kind of multiracial profiles of families. Splenda Sucralose, which is what it is, but the brand name Splenda, can be used in baking. I know many people who use it and bake things for their kids with it, with the notion that this is healthier for kids than sugar. So kids are a massive market at this point. The fear of type 2 diabetes, the rise in the obesity epidemic for kids, all of that makes kids a place where our worry about overeating has landed. So, yes, absolutely.
Let's take a call now. We're going to go to a listener in Urbana on line one. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I haven't heard the whole show, so if I'm asking a question that you've already covered, please excuse me. But stevia, I really don't know much about it, and I'm wondering if there are any I think I've tasted one drink that had it in it, and I just wondered if there are any health concerns about that or if it has reportedly strange aftertastes or anything else that you know of.
Sure. Stevia is different than artificial sweeteners because it's created from the leaves of the stevia plant. So, you know, stevia has been around a long time, and it's been used in a lot of other countries before it really hit the U.S. market. But now stevia is one of the fastest-growing products in low-calorie foods. And there, I do not know of health risks associated with stevia. It's not as sweet as, say, something like Splenda. Splenda is actually 600 times sweeter per part than table sugar, which is pretty astounding. Stevia is not. Some people don't like the taste of it. It has what I would kind of describe as a licorice aftertaste to it. It's not as intensely sweet as the other artificial sweeteners. So from a health perspective, although I'm no expert, I think it is a more desirable option than others. As a historian, the only caution that I have about stevia is, again, this kind of technological fix, although it's not really a technology. It is yet one more product. If you price it, it costs a whole lot more than table sugar. And it's one more way that, you know, we can have more sweets and take in more sweets than our bodies actually need in the form of calories. So I do worry a little bit that kind of rather than taking this moment when 60% of Americans do have some concern about artificial sweetener and whether it's good for them and maybe asking ourselves, could we just maybe have sugar if we're not diabetics, if we don't have a problem with it, and just have it a little less often, that stevia is presenting a now natural option that will then continue to allow us to sort of overconsume sweets.
Okay. Well, thank you for that information.
Sure.
You're welcome. Next, we take a call from a listener in Champaign on line two. Hi.
Yes. Perhaps I misheard you earlier, but it sounded as if you were suggesting that these companies creating the artificial sweeteners had good intentions. I thought you said that at one point. And I just wonder whether you, in your book, look at this effort to create a certain kind of consumer. And maybe you mentioned this earlier. I didn't catch that. But creating a certain kind of consumer, a consumer who will, let's say, I think you did suggest, you know, there are these notions of the nation and so forth with sugar. And, of course, sugar historically, it has a long history closely related to colonialism, right? American interest and major corporations in Dominican Republic and so forth. What I find interesting, actually, though, is over time, as you were saying, there's this change and a kind of, an effort to sort of demonize sugar at a certain point and to bring in artificial sweeteners. One thing I'm not quite clear on, though, is my sense is that Americans are much more open to kind of experimentation with their bodies. Maybe this kind of consumer has been created over time, I'm not sure, but I study another culture, and I've noticed in their case and in those of other internationals I know that now, and I think historically as well, they're much more hesitant to try all manner of artificial sweeteners and so forth. One thing else in addition, I was wondering, I've always heard that you can't patent a living thing. This is, maybe that's commonly known, but I always sensed that, you know, since when I was a child, you could, you know, what we now call classic potato chips was all there was as of roughly the early to mid-1970s. I've always associated these artificial sweeteners and artificial snacks and so forth with the kind of effort of these companies to compete by patenting new substances or create new substances that they can patent in a way that will make them profit. So anyway, a lot to answer there, though. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for the call.
Great, though. So the first point, you know, did I say they had good intentions? Well, yeah, that's... I did really start this project from a kind of objective point of view, thinking, you know, in my view as a historian of technology, one of the things that's astounding about the history of food in the U.S. is that it's been this place of innovation, and that's very different than, say, a European relationship to food. It's very different than a German relationship, that there has been a lot of creativity within the food industry, and I don't think we know that story. You know, we spend a lot of time in our discussions about food talking about, you know, what should we eat, as if, you know, if we only made the right decision, we would be healthy people, rather than looking more at what kinds of interests and what kinds of people have created these foods in front of us and the messages behind them. So I did find in the archives, you know, very good intentions, and in some ways exactly what you suggest, that if I look specifically at Abbott Laboratories in the 1950s and a canning company in Northern California, I mean, there's a 20-year archive of back-and-forth letters between these guys involved in the story. And, you know, the canning guys are looking to sell more product. They want to be the first on the market. They want to have something that no one else has, and they want to improve profits. At the same time, they are exchanging letters where the canning executives are saying, you know, could this really be good for people? And the pharmaceutical guys are providing information about how many more Americans are obese every year. And they're really encouraging the canners to come on board so that they can do what they need to do, which is sell food. But they can do it in a way that lets them sleep at night, because their food actually will make people healthy. And I think that's a story we overlook. Because, you know, I mean, we focus on the results, which are very disappointing for a lot of Americans trying to make good choices. But nonetheless, the fact that food scientists and chemists want to create healthy options within an economic system that demands continual innovation and increasing market share and moving more product through bodies, I think that tension is really important for us to understand historically. We have to find a way that the food industry can be creative and innovative and, you know, expand market share that doesn't ultimately damage our bodies. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure we can leave that to the food industry to figure out. The other thing that I would add is I think that the U.S. is different. You know, maybe we could trace this back to just that kind of core concern of Protestantism, right, that you want to do without. You want to be restrained. You want to believe that you can make a good choice, that you have to be virtuous. Robert Crawford has written about this, that, you know, for Americans, often making a healthy choice is the same thing as being healthy. And if you ask people about being healthy, it's about going to the gym or intending to go to the gym or knowing what, you know, what the nutritional information is in food, that desire to be virtuous in the midst of the opportunity to sin or to fall or to indulge, it is perhaps more American and may make us more susceptible to the kinds of claims that the, that these sorts of products make. Mm-hmm.
I want to thank the listener for his call. I've got one call I can't take. We're out of time. I have just enough time for one last little question. It's a big question, so my apologies. But earlier, Carolyn, you talked about someone coining the term prosperity stomach. Well, now we're seeing stories about rising affluence in places around the world, in China, for example. How are people elsewhere in the world dealing with prosperity stomach?
Well, in some ways, they're dealing with it through our own food industries. You know, the very products that we have had here that I talk about in the book are moving to other countries. We in the U.S. have gotten pretty good at figuring out how to move product by providing helpful information and things that have low-calorie options. And I was in a forum on China just a little while ago, and it's really fascinating to look at what will happen as food becomes cheaper. There's certainly an appetite for convenience products, big cars, and, you know, many of the kind of cultural conditions of the 1950s in the U.S., in fact, that are exactly what that prosperity stomach is about. You know, I would hope that we would learn some lessons from our own experiences with the continued rise of obesity. There is no technological fix. We can come up with all the substitute ingredients we want in our foods, but if we don't create a manageable relationship between our appetite and the need of business to sell, there is no way to pursue health.
Yeah. And one last word here I'll give to a listener who has written in by email. Thanks for the program. And the bottom line here in her comments, don't you think that an overly sweet diet, she says, everything is sweet, and an overly sweet diet crowds out the joy we can get from a richer variety of food tastes and textures?
Absolutely. It's something sensory scientists are exploring. When Splenda is 600 times sweeter than sugar, it's not just a diet choice that we're making. It's also a choice to really overwhelm our palate with sweetness. And I wonder if the rise in corn syrup consumption, which, of course, happens at the same time that the rise in diet artificial sweeteners are happening, doesn't, in fact, kind of negate any calorie savings we might have by grabbing that Diet Coke. Because as we get used to having that excessive sweet of these artificial products, we can't taste the sweetness in the rest of our diet in the same way.
And there we've got to leave it. We are out of time. Carolyn de la Peña, thank you so much.
Sure, thank you.
Our guest is the author of Empty Pleasures, the story of artificial sweeteners from saccharin to Splenda.